calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded? Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from coast to coast. Coming up today, more on human rights violations in Iraq, the Senate's position on detainee rights after only 1 hour of debate. Roy Mullins is going to join us with thoughts on how ExxonMobil should spend their huge third-quarter profits. Bill O'Reilly explains why it's okay to advocate in favor of terrorism, or he tries. Right. Our theme for the day, we lose our rights so slowly sometimes we fail to see the bigger picture. Breaking news, Chalabi meeting with Cheney and Rumsfeld. This from the Think Progress blog, the Associated Press reporting that Vice President Dick Cheney and Defense Secretary Don Rumsfeld met today with Ahmed Chalabi, the discredited neocon darling currently under FBI investigation for allegedly passing U.S. secrets to Iran. And this is what's so amazing about this. It must have been about a year ago. We had Scott Ritter on this program, and Scott Ritter was saying, you know, who's the real winner here? I asked him, you know, what's the deal? What's going on? Why the invasion of Iraq? Who's the winner? Who's making out on this thing? And he was just, you know, absolutely straightforward in this. And he says, the real winner here is Iran. Iran wanted this war. Iran is the winner from this war. No matter what happens, Iran wins if George Bush invades Iraq. And because Iran had spent millions and millions of dollars, the lives of perhaps a million of their young men. I mean, it's mind-boggling when you think about it. You know, a war in which a million people died or more. Chemical weapons were used by both sides. It was a horrific, horrific, bloody war. And Iran wanted nothing more than to get rid of Saddam Hussein. I mean, Iran's beef with Saddam Hussein was very similar to Osama bin Laden's complaints about Saddam Hussein. And that was, you know, very straightforward. Saddam Hussein allows women to vote. Saddam Hussein is allowing women to walk around in public with their elbows bared. Saddam Hussein is allowing women to participate in public discourse. Saddam Hussein is allowing women to work. He's allowing them to teach. He's allowing women doctors to work on women and men. How dare they? Saddam Hussein is not giving the clerics, he's not giving the mullahs veto power over legislation. He's running a secular state. Much like Jordan. Like King Abdullah is doing in Jordan. And so, you've got these crazed folks. Some would view them as crazed folks. If they called themselves Christians, obviously Pat Robertson, Jerry Falwell, and Bill O'Reilly would all call them, normal and great patriots. The point being that they believe that their religion should be the government of the state. And so Iran is saying, hey, wait a minute, we've got a secular state here in the middle of the Middle East, which should be entirely Islamic and should be entirely run by the mullahs. We can't have that. And so Iran committed hundreds of billions of dollars, A million lives to fighting against Saddam Hussein. And finally, you know, this war kind of works its way to a truce, to a ceasefire. And Iran is sitting there going, how can we get rid of this guy? And Osama bin Laden is asking himself the same question. Osama bin Laden goes off for his merry adventure into Afghanistan, where, you know, the CIA helps set up the Mujahideen to fight against the Soviet Union, because anything that's anti-Soviet is good in our book, right? The enemy of my enemy is my friend. And so we set up Osama bin Laden in Afghanistan to fight off the Soviet. He's successful. He thinks he walks on water now. He thinks he can do anything. He can take on it. He just fought back the Soviet Union, the second largest military power on Earth. 7,000 nuclear weapons, and he brought them to their knees. So Osama bin Laden, he goes back to Saudi Arabia and he says, hey, we got to take out that Saddam Hussein guy. He's running a secular republic right here in the middle between Afghanistan and Saudi Arabia. We could make all of the Middle East into an Islamic paradise run by the religious folks. who will tell you that you don't go along with their way, God's going to get you. And so Osama bin Laden organizes an army of folks, a couple thousand of his followers, and they start heading for the border. There's this huge border between Saudi Arabia and Iraq, where Saudi Arabia and Iraq meet. We're talking a border that's, I'd have to measure the miles, but I think, I think it's bigger than the border between California and Nevada. It's huge. It's a substantial border. And so, you know, he's going along, and the Saudis catch him and say, you can't do that. You can't attack Iraq. And he's like, you know, I sure can. And they're, nope. In fact, they deported him. They stripped him of his citizenship, and they threw him out of the country. They sent him off to Sudan. They said, that's it. You're out of here, Osama. Sorry. No more. And so Osama bin Laden goes, you know, off to Sudan and says, okay, now he is committed to not only bringing down Saddam Hussein, but also to bringing down the royal family in Saudi Arabia. How's he going to get to them? He's going to get to them by getting to their patrons. He wants to turn the entire Middle East against them. And who are their patrons? The Bush family and the United States. Well, I would say actually the United States first, the Bush family second. And so Osama bin Laden comes after us in multiple places in the Middle East and around the world, ultimately in 9/11, presumably. And Iran is sitting back going, you know, this is kind of cool. How can we get the United States, to take out Osama for us? I mean, we lost a million lives. We spent billions of dollars trying to make this thing happen. How can we get this to happen for free? It won't cost us a penny. You know, if we can just get George Bush to invade Iraq, he's got enough firepower to take out Osama bin Laden, or to take out Saddam Hussein. He can do that. And then we'll just, you know, march in. And the guy who facilitated it was Ahmad Chalabi. Ahmad Chalabi goes in and he says to the Iranians, I'll keep you up to date on what the Americans are doing. I'll tell you their secrets. And then he says to the United States, hey, you know, the nasty stuff that the Saddam Hussein regime is up to, I'll feed you that. I've got this guy Curveball, a distant cousin. He's an alcoholic, and he's, you know, he doesn't do all that well, but he'll tell you what you want to hear. And we'll find out some other information for you. So Chalabi and Iran conspire to get the United States into this. Now, let us be candid about this. George W. Bush was eager to go in anyway. I mean, you had the neocons in this administration who had been saying from the get-go, you know, hey, you know, we'd like to have something to do with this. We'd like to come after this guy. You know, back in 1998, they all signed this letter, the Project for a New American Century. They signed a letter. Jeb Bush, Dick Cheney, Paul Wolfowitz, Doug Feith, Don Rumsfeld signed a letter saying to Bill Clinton, attack Iraq now. And Clinton's going, why? We've got Saddam in a bottle. As, by the way, Condoleezza Rice said in the first 2 months after she became National Security Advisor, as Colin Powell said, this is all before 9/11. But George W. Bush, he's back there going, you know, I'd really like to have a good excuse to invade. I really need a good excuse to invade, because if I can invade, I can take these guys out. I mean, you know, just cool stuff can happen, like I'll get political capital. This, by the way, is where I have to differ from so many of the other folks out there who are saying, well, the reason that we invaded was for oil, for example. I think that was a tremendous benefit. And it's interesting that if Iraq is a proxy of the United States right now, Iraq is a member of OPEC, then we now have, you know, a pretty good foot inside OPEC. So what are we going to do? Are we going to, on the one hand, say OPEC is a cartel, it's a violation of the basic principles that America is founded on, we're not going to have anything to do with it, we're not going to go with it, we're going to get rid of OPEC, we're going to, you know, Iraq is just going to sell oil at the market price and glut the market and drop the price of oil, or are we going to say, Iraq's part of OPEC and we're going to continue to participate in this price-fixing scheme that OPEC has been doing for decades? See, the neocons originally, when they were saying attack Iraq, part of their rationale was, this will give us an inside with OPEC, and we can bring down OPEC. Now they're not saying that anymore, oddly enough. They're starting to back away from that. So anyhow, at the center of this, the spider at the center of this whole web, George W. Bush wanting his political capital, Dick Cheney wanting the oil, and his oil buddies, you know, his oil industry buddies wanting the oil, Wolfowitz, Feith, and all these other guys saying that, what they wanted was basically, you know, to be players in the Middle East. And then you've got Chala, and then you've got Iran saying, you know, we want Saddam out. The spider in the middle of all of it, Ahmed Jalabi. And he meets today with Cheney and Rumsfeld. No cameras, behind closed doors. What a surprise. 16 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Our telephone number, 1-866-440-THOM. That's 1-866-440-8466. If you want to drop into our live chat room, go to tomhartman.com and just click the live chat link. It'll get you right in there. And remarkable day. I mean, this is like the fact that Chalabi met with the vice, a guy who has been convicted of bank fraud in Jordan and is facing over 20 years at hard labor. If he ever steps foot on Jordanian soil, the Jordanians are still trying to figure out what to do. The other day, a couple nights ago, I believe it was Wolf Blitzer, one of our reporters a reporter here in the United States, was asking King Abdullah of Jordan, you know, what are you going to do about Chalabi? He's like, you know, next door. He's here in the United States. You know, what are you, isn't he a convicted bank robber, essentially, you know, bank fraud?
Well, yes, we're trying to figure out how to resolve this issue. Well,
what does that mean? Does it mean that King Abdullah of Jordan is trying to figure out how to, like, release him from, you know, have another trial and decide he was not guilty? Or maybe he'll give back some of the millions that he looted from the bank? Or that they're just all going to agree to, you know, pretend it didn't happen. Just kind of ignore it. I don't know. It's, you know, one of those amazing, confusing things. Absolutely amazing, confusing things. Today, the Senate, this also from Think Progress, the Senate is expected to decide whether the fundamental rights of habeas corpus that they were going to strip away from the Guantanamo Bay detainees, this because of Lindsey Graham's amendment last week, whether they're going to do that. You know, we'll see how that shakes out and where that goes. But back on Iran, just for a second here, Dennis in Phoenix, Arizona on the line. Hey, Dennis, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, I just wanted to see if you could is there a book or something I could kind of, is there something I could read about the whole, you kind of just dissected the whole last few years of what happened in Iran and the Middle East, and is there something I could read to kind of catch up on that, or?
You know, I'm not really sure. Scott Ritter's written a couple of nice op-ed pieces that have appeared on Common Dreams and other places, and you might just be able to Google them. And
okay.
I'm not sure if he has a website. And he has a book out now, which I have to candidly admit I've looked through, but I haven't read every word in it. So I don't know to what extent he goes into this kind of detail. He certainly, you know, has been. He was the guy who first gave me the forehead slap, you know, the aha. This was, you know, a couple of years ago when he was on this program. And I was like, you know, okay, people are saying it's for oil. People are saying it's for, you know, Bush to get political capital. Why do you think it is? And he said, it's Iran. You know, Iran is winning this deal. He said, he didn't suggest, I don't want to be putting words in Scott's mouth, but he wasn't suggesting that the Bush administration was doing it for Iran, like they're going to do him a favor or something.
Mm-hmm.
But that really I said, who's going to win the war in Iraq? Iran wins no matter who wins, period. And look at now, you've got suicide bombers in Jordan from Iraq. There hasn't been a suicide bombing in Iraq in the 7,000-year history of that country. And now they're exporting suicide bombers. Turns out this woman, her brother was killed in Fallujah. Fallujah was a brutal assault, an absolutely brutal assault on the city. By the rules of war, you could argue it might have been necessary if you actually had a necessary war. That's a whole other thing. But nonetheless, a lot of civilians were killed. And a lot of people who viewed themselves as simply defending their homes were killed. And that's why they're called insurgents rather than terrorists. And so now we've got, I mean, this is what happens when you go in and you try and occupy a country and you kill people, you get a bunch of really angry people. So anyhow, there's not to the best of my knowledge, a good book that summarizes it. Dennis, the other book that I'm almost reluctant to recommend, but I think you'd find fascinating, is Pat Buchanan wrote a book called Where the Right Went Wrong. And the first, I don't remember how many chapters in the book. Let's say there's 10 chapters. The first 9 chapters, and it's all except the last chapter, are just an excellent dissection of how, you know, the Bush and the neocons and how they blew it and how they're going to inflame the Middle East and the whole idea of empire is stupid and all this stuff. And then he's got a gratuitous last chapter where he says, oh, and the Republicans are wonderful and we've got to take back the Republican Party, blah, 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 blah. And if you ignore the last chapter, it's actually a pretty good book.
It's interesting that you're recommending a Pat Buchanan book, but I'm going to go read that.
I know. I'm choking as I'm doing it. I got to tell you, because I have a lot of problems with Pat Buchanan, but on this one topic,
I'm going in there buying it. But thanks very much.
Yeah, on this one topic, you really had it. Melinda in Pasaukin, New Jersey.
Yes.
Hey, Melinda. We have about a minute left. What's up?
I just wondering if it was possible that this whole thing with Ahmed was a setup so that people would vote for him. And it worked because now he's oil minister.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. I mean, this is all about Chalabi. Chalabi's father was the richest man in Iraq. And Saddam Hussein came in and kicked the guy out and said, we're going to nationalize the oil industry. We're going to take it over. Chalabi wants to once again be the richest man in Iraq and the most powerful man in Iraq. And he's on his way to it. And he's used the United States to get there. And we
are complicit because we made him look bad in our eyes and made him look good in Iraqi eyes because he seemed anti-American when we were trashing his house.
That's right. That's right. He's it wouldn't surprise me at all if he's the one who set that up. If he was the one who leaked the information to the U.S. that caused the U.S. to come and you know, tear apart his house and his office so that that story could, and so that he could, you know, flee to Iran so that that story could hit the Iraqi press.
Right.
So that the Iraqis would then say, hey, this must be a good guy.
Because
remember that old saying, you know, the enemy of my enemy is my friend, is like, that's got a 7,000 year history in that region.
Worked like
Melinda,
a dream.
Yeah, it really did. This is Chalabi's war, if anybody's. Melinda, thanks for the call. Great to hear from you, and I appreciate your calling in. It's 27 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from California to Pennsylvania, beaming down from outer space on the Sirius satellite system, satellite radio system, beaming around the planet on airamericaradio.com, whiteRoseSociety.org, radiopower.com, radiopower.org, excuse me. Senator Mark Dayton is with us of Minnesota. Senator Dayton, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Tom.
The Democrats are putting forward an amendment. Harry Reid just issued a press release about this, a way forward in Iraq. Can you tell us about this, sir?
Well, the amendment, unfortunately, was defeated, and a substitute amendment, which is basically pirated from the Democratic amendment by Senators Warner and Frist, was included, adopted. But the real difference is that the Democratic amendment said in its final paragraph, a campaign plan with estimated dates for the phased redeployment of the United States Armed Forces from Iraq as each condition is met, with the understanding that unexpected contingencies may arise. The Republicans rejected that. You know, they're still just stay there for the eternal quagmire. The language is not stay any longer than required, but there's no definition of what's required. And so at least they've taken the step of acknowledging, as the heading of their amendment says, that we need to recommend changes to the policy of the United States on Iraq and to require some reports from the administration about what's going on there and what their timetable is and what they expect to accomplish and what they need to achieve before we can go home with a victory secured. So there's a step forward, but they're still a long ways from wanting to put the administration on to account.
But, Senator Dayton, we're building, I believe it's 17 major military bases there. We've got an embassy there that's costing $1 billion. It's going to be the largest embassy, United States embassy in the world. That doesn't sound, I think, probably to most Iraqis and certainly to many Americans like anybody's planning on, you know, America's planning on leaving there any day soon.
No, I couldn't agree with you more. I think this is the unending quagmire, the way this administration is running again. And the president spoke last week in front of a banner that said strategy for victory. Well, he had spoke before a banner on the Abraham Lincoln carrier 2.5 years ago that said mission accomplished. He had the two banners mixed up. If we'd had a strategy for victory back then, we'd have mission accomplished today. And there's still no strategy for victory. They're just going one day at a time and hanging on until hopefully something better happens over there. But you're right. There's no plan to withdraw any time.
We're talking with Senator Mark Dayton of Minnesota. Many folks are suggesting, Senator Dayton, that the real winners in this whole thing, the real winner in this whole thing is Iran. That whether we pull out, whether we stay, you know, just the fact that Iran fought this, you know, nearly 10-year war against Saddam Hussein, lost 1 million of their citizens in it, spent billions of dollars trying to unseat Saddam because he was basically running a secular government and they wanted to have a theocracy in there. That they're the big winners. And Chalabi is now here in the United States saying that he's the guy who can help us prevent a theocracy from taking over Iraq. What do you make of that?
You think that over 2,000 brave Americans have lost their lives and thousands of others have been wounded or maimed so that Chalabi can become the next titular head of Iraq is just shameful. And, you know, the real winners in this are the terrorist recruiting operatives because we're turning, you know, the Arab world against the United States, and the CIA has a term called blowback, which is, means basically things boomerang back at you, and that's what we're going to be faced with for years to come as a result of this misguided policy.
Yeah, and so what are the Democrats suggesting that we do?
Well, we're suggesting that we require the administration to tell us, to tell the troops who are fighting over there heroically, who are trapped there indefinitely, to tell the Congress, to tell the American people what the strategy for victory is, they termed it, what it is, and how it's going to be achieved, and how we're going to know if we're making progress or not making progress, what the timetable is going to be. Let's turn the cards face up on the table here, and then we can have a debate about whether that's an acceptable policy or strategy or not. But right now, it's just, you know, hang on and trust us, and we're fighting the war on terrorism, which they've created as in its front in Iraq to the extent it exists there. It didn't exist prior to the invasion. Now, if that is the center point of the war against terrorism, it's because they've made it so. And so how are we combating it, and what's going on, and where is al-Qaeda, and when are we going to get Osama bin Laden and others flushed out, and what's the progress or lack of progress in doing that? I mean, the whole range of issues that should be for public knowledge and debated.
Yeah,
I've got to go vote here. I'm sorry.
Oh, you do? Okay.
There's a series of votes going on here on the defense authorization bill.
Yeah, well, great. Thank you for being with us. Senator Mark Dayton of Minnesota, much appreciated. Remarkable. So where do we go from here? Nobody knows. See, that's the problem. George W. Bush has walked us into an absolute unending mess, an absolute disaster. Joe in Columbia, South Carolina on the line. Hey, Joe, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom, I just wanted to ask you, when are we going to quit calling this a war and calling it an occupation? This is an occupation. War has a little bit of credibility. This doesn't have any credibility at all.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you. And in fact, when George W. Bush stood up on the aircraft carrier and said that, you know, we had won. In fact, here's the beginning of his little speech.
My fellow Americans, major combat operations in Iraq have ended. In the Battle of Iraq, the United States and our allies have prevailed.
And so, you know, in other words, he's saying the invasion was successful, and he was right. The invasion was successful. But now we have an occupation, and the occupation ain't going so well. You're absolutely right, Joe.
That's fact. That's a fact. And we need to get the hell out of, we need to get out of there. We don't need to be there.
Yeah, no, we have become the irritant. We have become the problem rather than the solution. Joe, thanks a lot for the call.
Thank you, sir. Good to hear from you.
I appreciate it. And you're spot on. And now we have the United Nations warning of human rights violations by all sides. This is from Agence France-Presse. The United Nations warned of human rights violations by all sides in war-torn Iraq and expressed concern at the increasing number of people held on terrorist-related charges. Now, keep in mind also that here in the United States, it's just absolutely amazing the number of people who have been investigated into the Patriot Act, thousands of people who, you know, Patriot Act have pulled their information, tens of thousands of people using the Patriot Act. This administration has pulled their information and outsourced it to commercial sources who then have the right to actually resell it. I should say our information. There's no doubt in my mind I'm part of that, and in all probability many of you are. And this giant sweep. Well, it's happening even, you know, even worse in Iraq. In Iraq, they're kicking in doors and sticking guns in people's faces. Here, it's a little more subtle. They get your credit card records. They find out where you're, you know, what websites you're looking at. They're listening to your phone calls, all those kind of things. But in Iraq, it's, you know, guns in faces, very serious stuff. And here in the bi-monthly Human Rights Report covering the period from September 1st to October 31st, this two-month period, the United Nations Assistance Mission in Iraq. This is the UN presence in Iraq, UNAMI, or UNAMI, I guess you could call it the acronym, said that, quote, large parts of Iraq continue to experience a general breakdown of law and order, and added that hundreds of civilians have been killed and wounded as a result of terrorist attacks, targeted assassinations, and extrajudicial execution-style killings. Hundreds of civilians. This in 2 months, from September 1st to October 31st. The report goes on to say, this is the United Nations report. This is not, you know, Bleeding Heart Liberals Incorporated. This is the UN. Massive security operations by the Iraqi police and special forces continue to disregard instructions announced in August 2005 by the Minister of Interior, that would be of Iraq, to safeguard individual guarantees during searches and detaining operations. Repeated bombing campaigns by armed groups against civilians in mosques are increasing fears that community relations are descending into a pattern of fear, animosity, and revenge. So all the news that we're hearing is that second sentence. It's that the insurgents are not respecting anybody's human rights, and nobody's disagreeing with that, certainly. But what we're not hearing here is that the government itself is also not respecting, as they say, not respecting the rights of the Iraqi people, tragically. Ongoing military operations, they add in this, the United Nations report, especially in western and northern parts of the country, continue to generate displacement and hardship for thousands of families and to have a devastating effect on the civilian population, the report said. While progress in reviewing cases led to the increase, to the release of hundreds of individuals who had been detained on so-called terrorism charges there. The overall number of detainees continued to increase due to mass arrests carried out during security and military operations. They gave no exact numbers on the number detained, but officials last month suggested that the United States and Iraq are holding some 18,000 Iraqis in U.S. and Iraqi-run jails. Now, what's wrong with this picture? We are holding more people in prison in Iraq than Saddam did. I mean, it's, well, you could say, what's wrong with the picture here in the United States? Why do we have more people in prison in the United States than any other country in the world? Well, I tell you, in Iraq, it's not because of crazy drug laws like we have in the United States. It's something really serious and really wrong is going on, and a good chunk of what's wrong is our presence there, is our messing with the system, is our, you know, getting our foot into it and just, you know, stirring the thing up in a really, really, really bad way. And then you have Pat Roberts come out, the chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee, Pat Roberts. You say his name and you think Pat Roberts' son. No, it's not. But in any case, Pat Roberts, the chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee, comes out and says, George Bush can no longer be unconditionally trusted. Yeah, for all practical purposes, he says, I think a lot of us would really stop and think a moment before we would ever go to war, ever vote for war, or to go and take military action. He says this at Fox News, the Republican. No, we don't trust George anymore. We're Republicans. We know what's going on. Oh, my. It's 45 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Harpin.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
So hey, there's a new American way. No one's serving those deserving, but there's less tax to pay. We abuse our might and mock the world as we say. Don't mess with the U.S. of A.
Now, you know, we used to say don't mess with the U.S. of A because we are the moral force in the world. We're not just the most powerful military machine in the world. We are also the most powerful moral machine in the world. And at that point, the world said, you know, yeah, okay, we will join you. And we had all these over 100 nations that adopted democratic reforms modeling us. And now they're fleeing from us. The damage that this administration has done in just 5 years is mind-boggling. I have to say, as a bit of a student of history, I don't think that we have ever had an administration that has done so much harm to the United States of America as this administration, as the Bush administration, to our reputation abroad, to our body politic at home. I mean, it is absolutely mind-boggling what they have done. And now you've got Ahmed Chalabi in town and the National Review's Byron York, another one of these conservatives. He comes out, you know, William F. Buckley's National Review. He comes out on Chris Matthews' show on Hardball last night. And Matthews is like, you know, why is the vice president and other administration officials like Rumsfeld seeming to reject the notion that this guy Chalabi is full of it? And York says, well, a couple of reasons. One, he's a high-ranking Iraqi official. Matthews says, yeah, thanks to us. York says, we do recognize his position. The other thing is, look, I think there's a lot of people in this administration who still believe there were weapons of mass destruction somewhere and that they were spirited away or in some way not found. Matthews is like, who would? Who do you know believes that? And York says, I'm not going to say any brand names, but they do believe that. Incredible. There are still this from thinkprogress.org, by the way, blog. There are still administration officials who believe there were weapons of mass destruction, and somehow Saddam managed to just sneak them out of the country. That's all. Just snuck them out of the country. Our telephone number, 1-866-440-8466, 866-440-THOM. If you want to drop into our live chat room, go to tom.com and click the link to the live chat. Rebecca in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Rebecca, what's on your mind today?
Good morning. Well, I watched John Bolton on C-SPAN. Oops, just a minute. Let me turn my – I've got my computer on here. Just a second. Did you happen to see John Bolton on C-SPAN?
I did not.
It's just hard to believe that he is – the ambassador to the UN. He's talking about the, quote, reforms that are needed, and he was asked a question. I can't remember which organization was. Oh, it was the security, what was it? Some kind of security organization. And he was asked the question about, let's see if I can remember it. Anyway, he said that he thought, of course, the United Nations deserved to be destroyed, but somebody asked him,
wait a minute, he said the UN deserved to be destroyed, our ambassador?
Not destroyed, but pretty much decimated as far as the way it operates. But let me tell you, the most interesting thing was they said, why do you think we've been able to avoid world wars since World War II? And he said, what role do you think the UN played in preventing world wars, another world war? And he said, practically none. He said the thing that prevented it was the U.S. deterrence.
Well, you know,
it's just terrible.
Yeah, and, well, actually, there is a little bit of truth to that, but that's the problem. You know, you take a little bit of truth and use that to create a whole theology around something.
But he said it's the major reason why we have not had another world war.
Yeah.
Anyway, it's on C-SPAN, and I would recommend everybody go and listen to it on C-SPAN.
We'll check it out. Really, Rebecca, thank you. Thank you very much, and thanks for the call. It's good to hear from you. The reality is that the mutually assured destruction, the deterrence, you know, from the founding of this country until just very recently, our position has always been, and the position of the civilized world, basically, historically, has always been, we don't initiate wars, we end them. And that was the whole principle of mutually assured destruction, the MAD theory. You know, Henry Kissinger was so in love with this, and there was actually, you know, I want to say, some small amount of rationality to it. It was used for irrational purposes, building, you know, enough missiles to destroy the world 100 times over. I mean, far more than we ever needed. But the fact of the matter was that if the Soviet Union started a war with us, we could end them. And if they end, and if we started a war with them, they could end us. And that prevented either one of us from starting a war with the other for a long, long time. And it also created incredible distortions and dislocations in world political structures, and how countries, you know, we ended up, instead of fighting with each other, we were fighting all these proxy wars, North and South Vietnam, for example, you know, over and over and over again, all these different proxy wars. But the reality is that we did, you know, our nuclear forces, to, you could argue, deterred the Soviet Union from invading us. They would argue that they're invading them. I mean, you know, who knows? But for Bolton to, well, it's just amazing. Beyond that, Bush, Alito now has come out, Samuel Alito has come out and said in 1985 that he personally believes that the Constitution does not protect a woman's right to abortion. This is all over the news. What's not along with it all over the news, although the folks at Think Progress pointed out well, is that George W. Bush, this is 20 years ago that Alito said this. In fact, exactly 20 years ago. And everybody, all the Republicans are saying, well, you know, he said that 20 years ago. That doesn't matter. Right? Doesn't, you know, 20 years, people change their minds. But keep in mind, when Bush nominated Harriet Myers, his whole thing was, we want somebody who's not going to change their mind. In fact, he said, and I quote, "Thirdly, I know her well enough to be able to say she's not going to change, that 20 years from now she'll be the same person with the same philosophy she is today, and that's important to me." He said, "It was important when I picked Chief Justice Roberts. It's important for me in picking Harriet Myers." Yeah, then presumably it's important in picking Alito, right? Brr. Scary stuff. Truly scary stuff. Program. Where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank. It's 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Covers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. Our telephone number, 866-440-8466. The website, tomhartman.com. The place where reason is our lifestyle choice. Jay Harmon is with us. It's our Bioneers segment for the day. Bioneers, founded in 1990, is a nonprofit organization that promotes practical environmental solutions and innovative social strategies for restoring the earth and communities. And Jay Harmon, our Bioneer for the day or for the week, is a naturalist, entrepreneur, and inventor, author of numerous patents in marine craft design and friction and cavitation reduction technologies. PaxScientific.com, PaxScientific.com, his website. Hey, Jay.
Oh,
welcome to the program.
How are you?
Glad to have you on with us. Reducing friction and cavitation is like when stuff is, you know, fluids are flowing through something and it starts rolling around inside, essentially, isn't it?
Well, a good way to think of it is if you're on a ferry on a boat going across the harbor, you see all those bubbles, all that white water coming out of the back. That's cavitation, and it really means wasted energy.
Oh, okay. All right. So what are some of the ways that your industrial designs can help the world? I mean, we've got a bit of a problem here. For example, in the United States, we're consuming, I think, 7 times more energy than the average European, for example.
Right. Well, basically, if you look at the work of Paul Hawken and Amory Lovins, they'll describe the fact that in the present age, our industrial world is about 2% energy efficient. When you look at taking the fuel from the ground, converting it, and then using it, we use about 2% of that fuel for good use, and about 98% of the energy we create is wasted.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when we look at nature, for instance, it's much more like 80 to 85% of the energy that nature uses is actually put to good purpose. So there's this enormous difference between natural efficiency and the efficiency we find in machines in the entire that have been produced through the entire Industrial Revolution.
Now, couldn't you argue that the reason why our machines are so much less efficient than, for example, a plant or an animal is because plants and animals have gone through millions of years of evolutionary process to incrementally and gradually but relentlessly increase their efficiency, whereas our machines are just beginning that process?
Exactly right. If you think about it, if there were a better way to do it, nature would have done it because of 15 billion years or 4,000 years, whatever your beliefs are. But
6,000, I think, is the number that they throw out. But
yeah,
still,
exactly.
Yeah.
But a lot of experiments, let's agree on.
Yeah.
And so that's what we've done, is looked at what are the core principles that nature is using to achieve those types of efficiency. And we were fortunate enough to make a discovery some years ago of a fundamental process, and we've been able to adapt that to all sorts of equipment and machinery.
Is that fundamental process what you call the PAX streamlining principle?
Exactly right.
Okay, and explain that in a way that, you know, everybody can understand, please.
Well, the simplest way I could put it is, you know, in the Middle Ages, people thought that the world was flat, and it wasn't until we discovered it was round that we started doing things like discovering the Americas, for instance. Well, right now we're living in a paradigm in science where scientists and technologists think that the shortest distance between two points being a straight line means that if you want to use the least amount of energy, you must travel in a straight line. And all of our plumbing and systems are based on that.
But nature doesn't have straight lines. And, for example, when we discovered that the world was round, we discovered that a straight line wasn't the shortest distance between two points.
Right. And nature never used a straight line. In fact, no straight lines existed before humans turned up. And even now, a straight line is just a myth. If you look at any, you know, even the facet of a diamond under a microscope, it's not straight.
Well, that's interesting. Absolutely straight lines just don't exist in nature?
Exactly right. And what happens instead is nature moves all fluids and all heat in fluids according to a particular geometry that is far from a straight line. In fact, it's a spiral that you see whenever you pull the plug out of the bath anywhere in the world. You end up with that whirlpool. Well, that spiral, the geometry of that spiral, is the path of least resistance and the flow path where you use the least energy.
Right, the golden something.
Yeah, golden ratio.
The golden ratio,
divine proportion,
yes.
That's been known as for a long time.
Yeah, and so you're suggesting that that principle, this principle that is used in nature, is something that you have been able to quantify, that you've been able to nail down, define, and apply to science and to technology.
Exactly.
Give me an example.
We work with universities. We have a number of very clever scientists on our staff. We've been able to, if you like, freeze the whirlpool in your bathtub and reverse engineer it, actually determine what are the mathematical constructs of that whirlpool. And having done that, we're then able to use that to design fans and pumps and turbines.
But doesn't that whirlpool exist in some part because the Earth is spinning? I mean, wouldn't, if the Earth stopped spinning, wouldn't you have a flow of water going down the drain that looked more like the edge of Niagara Falls? Wouldn't you just have a perfectly round circle with water flowing into it?
Well, actually, no, because all movement in our universe, and Einstein first postulated this, and physicists agree, all movement in our universe is swirling, or it's turbulent, and it's all movement is constructed to that same geometry that you find in your bathtub whirlpool. So no matter whether the Earth is spinning or not, if you're out in space, you know, if you think of solar flares, for instance, they're spiraling through space.
Although the sun is spinning.
The sun is spinning, yes.
Right.
But in fact, if you think about it, there's nothing in our universe that isn't moving.
Well, and in fact, if you want to throw a baseball straight or a football, you put a spin on it.
Right. So everything is constantly moving. Even a rock is decaying and dust is falling off it while you're looking at it.
Mm-hmm.
And all of that movement has this spin to it.
Remarkable.
So to stop the spin, you'd have to stop the universe, which is probably not going to happen easily.
We're talking to Jay Harmon. He's our Bioneer of the Week. His website, PAXScientific.com. And, Jay, just, you know, finally, what does this mean to the average person? What can we do about this? Or is this really something that we leave to folks like you and the scientists and the engineers out there?
Well, the great good fortune is that we're now licensing Fortune 100 companies, and whole product lines are being converted over to this type of thinking. And we expect that within 10 to 15 years, the world of manufacturers will be using these geometries in devices. And typically, we can see energy reduction between a third and 50% in any machinery or even kitchen fans and bathroom fans and pumps and so forth, turbines and power production.
That's marvelous. Good on you.
Yeah, thank you.
Good on you. That's great. Okay, so people can learn more about it by going to PAXScientific.com, presumably?
Yes.
Yes, okay, great. Jay Harmon, thanks for being with us today, Jay.
Thank you so much.
Much appreciated. Jay Harmon, our Bioneer of the Day, PAX, PAXScientific.com, his website. Fascinating stuff. Let's get back to politics for a minute. JC in Seattle, Washington, some thoughts on a solution to our foreign policy problems? Hey, JC, you're live and on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to make a couple quick comments, but your last scientist that was just on this actually could somewhat relate to that discussion.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm sorry. He's gone.
Hello?
Yeah, I'm here, but he's gone.
I know he's gone. Yeah. You weren't listening. Okay. I said I realized that he's gone, but it was in relationship to what he was discussing pertaining to what you discuss on a daily basis, which is politics and the insanity going on in this country. And that is this, Tom. Perhaps you and your show could utilize, you're a great intellectual, and you've written many books, correct? Hello?
I'm listening, JC.
Yeah, I'm asking you a question, though. You've written a lot of books, right?
Yes, I have.
Yeah. And you're a very intelligent human being. However, what I'd like to suggest for you in the future, because all your listeners, I think that they would enjoy this also. Your show's great. However, I have one comment to make. The last person that's the scientist that you had on was talking about energy and physics and metaphysics and things of this nature, and you could apply that somewhat to your radio show.
To politics, you mean?
Yes. And instead of just intellectualizing with so many people regarding all of the insanity going on both globally and internally within our country, that perhaps you could, rather than speak in a straight line, that you could speak more in the swirl. And by that I mean, here's my main question for you.
We're out of time, JC. I'm sorry. But, I appreciate the call and it took a while to get to the question, I guess. But, I suspect, however, had I asked Jay Harmon what he thought about politics, that we would get a pass on that. It's by and large, people particularly who are trying to do these things don't get involved in it. We could try it in the future. It's 16 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back, my friends. Defending America from the conservative weapons of mass deception. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Our number 1-866-440-8466, 866-440-THOM. Boy, there's a lot in the news today. I want to get into Judge Alito. We want to get back into Iraq. Greg Gorman with the Talk Radio News Service is going to be with us in just a second. First, Alice in Eureka, California. Hey, Alice, a quick comment?
Yes, Tom. Iran may well benefit from the U.S. doing battle with their enemies in Iraq. But we need to remember that they have been planning that invasion for some 10 years. I also have to believe that it is more than a coincidence this involvement is proving so profitable. Our treasury is going straight to Halliburton and Bechtel and Kellogg Brown and Root. We are being ripped off.
Yeah, well said, Alice. You always call with the pithiest and most well said comments. I appreciate that. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Great to hear from you. Greg Gorman is live from Islamabad, Pakistan, with the Talk Radio News Service. Hey, Greg, how's your trip?
My trip is wonderful, Tom. I am live in Islamabad, Pakistan. The Talk Radio News Service has been invited here with an organization called ARC, Americans for the Resolution of Kashmir. I'm standing next to the chairman, Bob Gaida, who is going to speak to you in a minute. And tomorrow, we will be taking a helicopter from Islamabad. We're flying to Kashmir to see what it's like on the ground 40 days after the October 8th earthquake that killed, on record, 80,000 people. But what we've heard on the ground here is that number is a lot higher, probably closer to 250,000 people have died.
Whoa. Okay. Greg, do you want me to speak to
you? Situation. Yes, I'm going to let you speak to Bob Guider right now.
Okay, great. Bob, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom.
Very quick question. In Kashmir, you have a region where you've got a lot of Hindus living and you have a lot of Muslims living, and somehow for many years they've managed to live in peace. In fact, it used to be a tourist paradise. You could go there and rent a houseboat and live on it for, you know, a summer or whatever. It has become an area, a real flashpoint in the world. Is it going to take an earthquake and all this massive death to bring together these two religious factions?
Well, the reality of it is it's 90% Muslim, and it has been for the most of the past 57 years.
So then the Hindus have been imposing a political pact on it?
The India has been imposing, basically, with 800,000 troops stationed. That's like 27 infantry line of control, and throughout an area that's about the size of two-thirds of the state of Minnesota.
Right.
There's been some thaw prior to this terrible tragedy between India and Pakistan with respect to their respective claims of ownership. Throughout all this, the Kashmiri people have been essentially crushed in the political turmoil or tug-of-war. This earthquake has produced some movement between India and Pakistan with respect to opening pathways between Indian-occupied and Pakistani or Azad Kashmir. Largely at this point symbolic, as of yet there have been no civilians allowed to cross, merely the exchange of supplies between the two armies, troops, right along the border.
Bob, do you think Bob, do you think that the best solution to this is a balkanization of Kashmir, a breaking it up into Hindu and Islamic, you know, areas, physical areas, or do you think that it's possible that without all these Indian troops imposing order or separating them from each other, or for that matter, oppressing the Muslims living there, if that's the way that they view it, or if that's the reality of it, frankly, I don't know, that it's possible to bring about peace with these disparate elements there?
Yeah, I think it is possible, and obviously we have to operate from the premise that it is, or there's no sense in even trying. This is the longest-standing conflict in U.N. history. It started with resolutions, or the issue, back in 1947 when the British pulled out of South Asia. There's a great deal of fear, I think, on the part of the Indians. We spoke today with one of the fellows, a fellow named Sardar Qayyum Khan, who was one of the original fighters, if you will, freedom fighters, that resisted the Indian onslaught into Kashmir. The premise of partition was based upon religious ethnicity. It was 90% Muslim, but instead of going as the agreement said with Pakistan, the leader, a fellow named Jawaharlal Nehru, instead acceded to India and created this problem. It was a total violation of the premise of partition, and there's not been any peace really since. But when the Berlin Wall came down in the early 90s, these Kashmiri says, you know, we've been waiting for 50 years and nothing's happening. There began to be some freedom fighters that began to actually take paramilitary action. Interestingly, the nation of India has characterized these people as terrorists, and they capitalized on the 9/11 and the subsequent world's, if you will, indignation towards extremists and Muslims in particular. They very carefully and cleverly concealed it. The fact of the matter is, UN definition of terrorism does not include people fighting for their own indigenous freedom.
Yeah, and it's a tough situation. I was in northern India, up in the Himalayas, just 5 years ago or so, when it was really flaring in Kashmir. It's not going to be an easy solution. Bob, good luck in the work that you're doing, and thanks to Greg Gorman for being with us. 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
And they look at you like they don't speak your language. And you're living at the bottom of a well.
And welcome back, my friends. It's trying to talk to Republicans, right? 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman with you, TomHartman.com, our website, 1-866-440-THOM, our telephone number, and oh my goodness, it must be time for us to, it must be time for us to have our official conservative alert for the day. Yeah, if I only had a brain, you know, it's how it goes. Here we go. This is incredible. Bill O'Reilly is going to publish an online enemies list. You will recall the other day on the radio, he came out with his famous...
You're not going to get another nickel in federal funds. Fine. You want to be your own country? Go right ahead. And if Al-Qaeda comes in here and blows you up, we're not going to do anything about it.
We're going to say, look, every other place in America is off limits to you except San Francisco. You want to blow up the Koi Tower? Go ahead.
Yeah, you want to blow up the Koi Tower? Go ahead. So, you know, a lot of Americans are going, don't like that. So, this was last Tuesday. He said that he's gonna, if they're gonna blow up the Koi Tower, fine. And now, then he came out and he said, well, these weren't really controversial comments. It's like Pat Robertson calling for the assassination of a foreign leader. Can you imagine if a Democrat did that? Call for the assassination of a foreign leader. Or if a Democratic talk show host called for Al-Qaeda to bomb, say, Ohio. I mean, can you imagine? And seriously called for it in a serious rant like that. Well, then he says, no, this is a satirical riff. And now he says, this is incredible. Now he says, some far-left internet smear sites have launched a campaign to get me fired over my point of view. He says, I believe they do this on a daily basis. This time the theme is O'Reilly's encouraging terrorist attacks. Unbelievably stupid, not unusual with these gutter snipes. And then he takes it to the next step. And then he says, I'm glad the smear sites made a big deal out of it. Now we can all know who was with the anti-military internet crowd. We'll post the names of all who support the smear merchants on BillO'Reilly.com. So check with us. Now, he hasn't done that so far. But this is really interesting. Bill O'Reilly is doing what Hitler did. I mean, this was one of Goebbels' major coups in the early years. That, in fact, this is why it was so many people in the United States were so uncomfortable about the TIPS program. Remember the Turning Your Neighbors program, the TIPS program, in the early years of Nazism in Germany. Well, it extended all the way through the end, but it started just a year or so after Hitler took power. You could call your local Nazi office and denounce your neighbors, and they would do an investigation. If they found that the neighbors weren't good Nazis, they would report it. The denunciations would be reported on the radio stations. This was before television, of course. And your names would be broadcast. So, I mean, so here we have O'Reilly. He's going to broadcast the names. Amazing. Amazing. It shouldn't surprise us, but amazing. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Sam in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Sam, you wanted to talk about the last segment there where we were talking with Greg and his friend in India.
Yes.
Or in Pakistan, actually.
Yes. Tom, long-time listener. Love your show.
Thank you.
I just want to make a couple of points. Those two gentlemen from Islamabad, they obviously stated Pakistan's opinion on the facts. And I just want to say India is a secular country. We have the second largest Muslim population in the world outside of Indonesia, and we are a secular country and we are democratic. Also,
yeah, in fact, India is arguably the largest democracy on the planet.
Yes, and also when the British left South Asia and the partition between India and Pakistan was on religious lines, but remember, India at that time had a lot of princely states, and Kashmir was a princely state. It was a kingdom, and the document states that when the British and India and Pakistan leaders wrote a document about partition, they said that the prince decides who to accede to.
And oh, interesting. So because Pakistan had a prince, but the prince wasn't Nehru.
Kashmir had a prince.
I mean, yeah, because Kashmir had a prince, but the prince was not Nehru.
No, he was not.
And
he was a Hindu. Yeah, he was not Nehru, but he was a Hindu.
But they were saying that
the Prime Minister of India, yes.
Right, but they were saying that Nehru made this decision. Was it
not Nehru?
Nehru ratified the decision.
Yes, and also you should remember there were about 25% of the population of Kashmir was Hindu, and they've been there for centuries. I mean, and there are right now refugees in their own country. I mean, they were chased away, killed, raped. I mean, their homes looted and. They had to leave their country. I mean, they're not the country, but their state and their homes. And they're refugees in Delhi. They're spread all over in India now.
Yeah, I know that it's not a good situation in Kashmir. I have some friends who spent a lot of time there back in the 1950s when apparently it was actually a fairly peaceful place. They spent almost a year there. But as I said, I was near that region. We were up in Dharamsala, which is, 400 or 500 miles, I suppose, from the border.
Dalai
Lama's home, and there were actually, there were some concerns among some of the people that we were traveling with that the fighting might even spill into that region, so it was getting fairly hot. Sam, what do you, looking at it from the Indian point of view, what do you see as the solution to the region?
Well, the troops there are not imposing their will. I mean, if you look at the situation now and you read the reports, and I have a couple of friends who live in the southern part of Kashmir, and they say the people are sick and tired of the militants. They're terrorists, in my opinion. I mean, you might call them freedom fighters or whatever, but in our opinion, people who kill innocent human beings, I mean, they are terrorists. So the solution, I mean, right now we have Pakistan-occupied Kashmir and Indian Kashmir. And, I mean, my perspective, the line of control becomes the international boundary, and, that would ideally be the solution. I mean...
So Balkanization, basically. Break it up into the Islamic State and the...
No, because remember, India is a secular country. We have 15% of the Indian population is Muslim. So, you cannot divide... Kashmir by religious lines. I mean, the United Nations.
But the religious lines follow ethnic lines and follow language lines as well, don't they?
No, I mean you have Muslims all over India. I mean the southern.
I'm talking about in Kashmir.
Yes, but you have. What about the refugees living in Delhi and elsewhere in India who were chased away from their homes?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you should be fair to them. I mean, they're living in tents in Delhi now.
These being the primarily Hindu refugees.
Yes.
Yeah. So you're suggesting that. So again, it sounds to me like what you're suggesting is that that Kashmir should be partitioned, that the partition should be permanent, and that the partition should be along ethnic/language/religious lines. That there should be an Islamic Kashmir, and there should be what will largely be Hindu, but it won't be a Hindu state. It would be presumably a secular state aligned with India Kashmir.
Well, the Kashmir rally right now, the Indian Kashmir rally, still has 80%. I'm not sure about that, but more like 70% Muslim. I mean, we live peacefully with Muslims in India. I mean, the reports coming in the media in the West always, for some reason, they show that Muslims are not equally treated in India. I mean, in fact, it's totally the opposite. So.
We have to acknowledge, Sam, India is not without some ethnic strife. I mean, I've spent a fair amount of time in India, and there are reports in the newspapers about Muslims who feel that they are being discriminated against, and Hinduism in particular has played a role in elections. I'm forgetting the name of the guy who is your current prime minister, the conservative, but he was, in the last election, was promoting his Hindu credentials. Was he not?
No, actually, it was a coalition government, and yes, they were the majority, and their common minimum agenda, because they formed a coalition with other secular parties. Mm-hmm. They basically put aside all their right wing driven agenda.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they lost power. It's not like, and they are changing. I mean, that party right now, you're talking about the BJP, Vajpayee,
yeah,
was the prime minister.
Yeah,
yeah. I mean, he's mellowed down now. I mean, that party is more centrist now.
Yeah. Well, he wasn't so mellow when I was there 5-6 years ago, I'll tell you.
Well, not the prime minister. The deputy prime minister was actually...
Yeah. He was the guy who was... Yeah. I just remember it. You know, I have to confess, the details of it and the subtleties of it are all beyond me, because I haven't spent enough time with the politics of it to know. I mean, I've spent a lot of time in the countryside in India, but and in a couple of the big cities. But just, you know, getting in at that level of detail. And I suspect that my ignorance of that is echoed all across the United States. I suspect the average American is clueless, frankly, about what's going on in that part of the world.
I mean, the Western media always, especially since 9/11, Pakistan has become a darling. And, I mean, basically, they are an Islamic state, and India is a secular country. And
well, it's not so much that it's an Islamic state. I mean, Sharif would say that it's Musharraf would say that it's a well, he tries to call it a democracy, but I mean, basically, what it is it's a dictator, a military dictatorship. You've got a guy who overthrew a democratically elected government, a military coup, don't you, in Pakistan?
Yes.
I mean, that's all ultimately the bottom line, and so. Sam, thanks for the call. Thanks for enlightening me. You know, step by step, we'll figure this stuff out. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. Our telephone number, 866-440-8466. It's 45 minutes past the hour. The Tom Hartman program. News without global conflicts of corporate interest.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
What a wonderful, wonderful world this could be. What a wonderful, 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 wonderful world.
Yeah, well, maybe. You never know what could come about. Welcome back to our program, my friends. It's about 9.5 minutes before the hours. Tom Hartman here with you. Andy Borowitz weighs in. The theory of dumb design may explain Pat Robertson out of the controversial debate pitting the theory of evolution against the theory of intelligent design has emerged a new theory, dumb design, which some experts believe may explain the televangelist Pat Robertson. Theory of dumb design holds that human beings were designed by a superior being, but one who mysteriously designed humans in a particularly dumb way. Reverend Robertson, who many experts in the theory of dumb design are calling Exhibit A in their effort to prove that the theory holds water. Dr. Davis Logsdon of the University of Minnesota, one of the leading advocates of the dumb design theory, says, if you take a look at Pat Robertson's brain and mouth and how they work or do not work in concert, you have a fairly persuasive argument that the theory of dumb design is valid. The theory of dumb design began to gain traction in August when Reverend Robertson called upon the U.S. to assassinate Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez. And last week, when he warned the people of Dover, Pennsylvania, that God would strike them with the natural disasters after they removed school board members who favored teaching creationism, the theory of dumb design seemed to achieve critical mass. But even an adherent of dumb design like Dr. Logsdon warns against putting too much stock in the theory, adding, no one theory could possibly explain all the things Pat Robertson says. Yeah, could be. Oh, my. Our telephone number, 1-866-440-8466. George in Palm Beach, Florida. Hey, George, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, Tom.
Yes, sir.
How you doing? Great job.
Thank you.
In regards to your comment in the segment before about the damage that this administration has done to the United States,
yeah.
I mean, economically, world affairs, everything, do you think, I mean, we're seeing the Republican Party start to melt down, I guess, and eventually it's going to catch up with them. Do you think it will happen, or it's wise that when the Democrats finally regain power, that they should ferociously go after this and pursue it as far as what it is, corruption, treason, any crime that can be pinned on anyone as far at the top as they need to go. I mean, do you think it would be divisive or wise to do that? I think it's the only way for the United States to recover its reputation.
Well, it's not just recover its reputation, it's heal from it. You know, if we were talking about Tom DeLay taking corporate PAC money in corporate money in Texas and you know, laundering it through the RNC, that would be one thing. You know, that's a crime. It's illegal in Texas.
That's
illegal in Texas. It's not illegal in Oregon. That's the kind of thing where two adults, two consenting adults having sex, you know, Bill Clinton and Monica Lewinsky.
Yeah.
Those are the kind of things where you can say, you know, yeah, you know, we don't really need to make a big deal out of this. This is not a big deal. But we're talking right here about at least 25,000 dead human beings and possibly well over 100,000. In fact, probably well over 100,000. And those deaths, I believe, demand a certain level of accountability to which this administration is refusing to be held and aggressively refusing to be held. In fact, Bush's latest shtick now is that he's pointing the finger at the Democrats and saying they were in this, too. You know, don't just pick on me. And it's really getting rather shrill and falling apart. One of the things that I find really interesting, George, is that I'm wondering what has happened to Frank Luntz. Frank Luntz is the master NLP practitioner in the Republican Party, the guy who has come up with all their phrases and has done such a brilliant job of stage managing the way they use language. And one of the core principles of NLP is the concept of embedded commands. And embedded command is where you say something in context A at the conscious level. The unconscious mind takes it in context B. You know, the easy example, you know, don't think about an elephant. What do you have to do? Your unconscious mind has to think of an elephant just to understand that. At a more subtle level, it'd be things like saying something like, George, I know that you, like me, agree that potato chips are great. Now, your conscious mind thinks we're just talking about potato chips. Your unconscious mind hears me say, you like me, right? And George Bush is now out there saying, our opponents are saying that, you know, somebody lied and people died. Or George Bush, you know, saying that, you know, somebody twisted intelligence that we twisted intelligence. And what happens is that people at an unconscious level are hearing the message from Bush that he's the guy who committed the crimes. And, you know, I don't think Frank Luntz would allow this. And so I'm wondering if the people who so masterfully engineered all the extraordinary successes of the Republican Party in the first 4 years have just bailed ship. And I'm wondering if part of that is the giant rift that's happened within the Bush family itself. You know, that Poppy Bush and George Jr. are essentially no longer talking. And that a lot of the old line Republicans have just bailed out, and they're not helping him anymore. And so now he's just kind of flailing around on his own, because he is saying things in public that, you know, understanding the subtle level that these kind of political speeches work, are really destructive to him himself. So
definitely, but it's just like John Kerry, you know, like he was talking about, I'm afraid they'll call me a sore loser. Do you think the Democrats are going to say, well, we don't want to really pursue this because then we're going to be called bad sports and divisive to the country and so forth? This is worse than Watergate.
I know. Yeah. Heaven only knows what the Democrats are going to do with this. And part of that problem, frankly, George, is that the Democratic Party itself is at war with itself. You have part of the Democratic Party that has adhered, you know, for a long, long time to the solid traditions of America and, you know, the Roosevelt part of the party. And then you got another large chunk of the Democratic Party that's just aligned itself with the Democratic Leadership Council and figures, you know, being pro-war is the way to go, being pro-corporate is the way to go, and, you know, pass us another big check, please. We'd like another contribution. And until those two factions, the party, resolve their differences, it's going to be a challenge. And frankly, my hope is that the DLC faction ends up being exposed and rolls over, but time will tell. Time will tell. It's going to take a lot of pressure, or it becomes enlightened, frankly. I don't see this as a we have to defeat them, but rather as a we have to wake them up. And that's something that we all do all the time.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Speaking from behind the good old stainless steel working class microphone here in the People's Republic of Portland, Oregon, broadcasting live from coast to coast. Tom Hartman here with you. Ross Mullins is with us. Ross has pursued an active career in the varied commercial fisheries of the PWS Cooper River area. He's been both an owner and operator of various vessels, this up in Alaska. Hey, Ross.
Yeah, good morning, Tom. How are you?
Good morning. Welcome to the program. ExxonMobil has still not, they just declared the largest profits in the history of the human race. 176,000 years we have human fossils going back, and this is the biggest profit in history. And yet they still have not paid for the Exxon Valdez spill?
Well, that's pretty much the picture, Tom. We've been waiting now since 1994. Our case has been in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, where Exxon is trying to fight every element of it, and we are still waiting. I like to think of it as we're dying up here. There's been over 4,000 of the plaintiffs die since this case began, and that's out of a total of 32,000-plus individuals. So well over 10% of the people have passed on already.
The people who were harmed by this, who are suing on behalf of themselves and their interests. Are you one of those folks, Ross?
Yes, as a commercial fisherman, my business was severely impacted by the oil spill. We had several years of failed runs in the pink salmon fishery, which was one of the major resources here. And then when the herring crashed and have yet to come back, that removed another 50% of the income from many folks in this region who used to utilize herring as part of their economic return every year. So in general, it's had a devastating effect on the communities and the individuals that participated in the commercial fisheries up in this area of Cordova, Alaska, where I live, and Prince William Sound, which we look at as our backyard, really, and that's where, of course, the spill occurred in 1989.
How has your business done since then? Have things come back?
Actually, things went downhill for quite a few years after the spill. Like I say, the herring collapsed in 1993, and there's been no herring fishery since that time. The pink salmon failed in 92 and 93, largely because the juvenile fish that were going out of the system during the year of the spill, where all the oil was on the surface, probably were impacted and caused some genetic problems in that resource. So it's had a harmful effect on my business. I had to refinance my operations in 1994, and I never did quite get back from that with the big payments and everything. And, the price gradually declined. We were in 89, or actually 88, the year of prior to the spill, we were averaging for pink salmon about 87 cents a pound. It got up into 1998, 99, 2000, where the price of pink salmon was down around 5 to 8 cents a pound. So you can imagine what kind of impact that would have. Now that's largely due to world market conditions. But
yeah, I was going to say, it seems like the opposite of how things should have gone. If it becomes more scarce, it should be more valuable, shouldn't it?
Well, you'd think that, but we lost a lot of marketplace shelf space in 1989. You probably recall a lot of the jokes that were going on. I remember one DJ pair in Seattle who opened a can of salmon, and they were talking about all the oil and et cetera. And I think it just put people off worldwide from buying canned salmon for a while. And pink salmon is pretty much a canned product, although they're now starting to use a lot more different product forms, such as fillets and all.
Right. So now we have the CEO of ExxonMobil, Lee Raymond, one of the five oil company executives who the Republicans in Congress refused to swear in, who testified before Congress that their profits were really none of our damn business. And ExxonMobil continuing to fight this lawsuit. What is the basis that they're using? How do you think this thing is going to play out, Ross Mullins?
Well, Exxon's contention was that they are good corporate citizens. They address the cleanup and spend a great deal of money on cleanup. You know, there's still a lot of oil out there under the gravel and the beaches that were oiled, but it's really impossible to ever meet or remediate that type of thing without just literally digging up the beaches, and that's not really acceptable at this point in time. But Exxon's contention is they cleaned everything up. It's back to normal, better than ever, and that's a typical way they PR this thing. When we had a meeting with them in 4 days after the spill in 89 in March, they said, from their representative, Don Cornett, they said, don't worry, if your nets don't fill up, we will make you whole. And
ExxonMobil said this.
Exxon is here rather than some leaky Greek. And I guess if making us whole is the criteria, we're still waiting. And as things evolve, they've gotten better, obviously. You can't go on downhill forever. But I'd say in the last 5 years, the fisheries come back to normal. We have a big hatchery system here that produces a lot of fish, and that's pretty much been keeping the commercial fleet busy. So, you know, but people, the problem, I believe, is primarily psychological. I mean, people who are really severely, severely impacted in 1989, many of them never have been able to get over it. They've never been able to get their financial lives back together. They've basically been struggling psychologically for these years, waiting for closure, and we don't get closure. We're still in the Ninth Circuit. 2 years now since it came out of the final remand to the for the district court in Anchorage, and we're still wondering why we're not getting addressed at the Ninth Circuit level. We've had many years where they're just sitting on it, and it's extremely puzzling. It makes you wonder if politics is not somehow involved here.
Well, I want to get into that, Ross. We're talking with Ross Mullins, who's a commercial fisherman in the PWS Copper River area there in Alaska. And I'm first of all, there's this website, pwsfrap.org. What is that, Ross?
Well, that website has evolved over the last several years. Myself and a partner, Ken Adams, we felt during the 90s, let me just go back.
Let me just interrupt you for a second. PWS is Prince William Sound, right?
Yeah, Prince William Sound.
Okay, so PWS,
Prince William Sound Fisheries Research Application and Planning.
Okay, thanks.
And on that site, there's a in-the-media link that can take you, shows you a lot of historical information on the spill and the fishermen's attempts to get justice in this thing. It's informative, although it's primarily up there for purposes of developing this science project. We've held many workshops about fisheries matters and things of that nature, so a lot of good information there. But going back to 93, 92, when there was really little science getting conducted, the fishermen blockaded the oil transport system in Valdez using their, in 1993, when their seine fishery had just utterly collapsed. You couldn't even generate enough revenue to pay your insurance and et cetera. The fishermen just got so angry they drove their boats to Valdez Arm and they blockaded the tanker lanes there for 3 days until they were forcibly removed by the Coast Guard. This drew the attention of the federal government, and ultimately we were able to get an investment here from the settlement funds that Exxon had paid as criminal part of their criminal penalties. We were able to get about $20 million invested in Prince William Sound to do what they call the C program, Sound Ecosystem Assessment. And out of that program came a number of different bodies of work, several of which were mathematical models trying to show how the ecosystem functioned. And unfortunately, those models weren't completed when that program was closed out. Our task with this PISFRAP.org group has been to elevate that body of science to a current day. We're bringing, in fact, we just got funded for another year about 5 days ago, and we're going to be bringing that model to Cordova and having it updated to present time. The principal investigator, Dr. Vince Patrick, who worked on this for 5 years in the 90s, will be coming to Cordova to actually
work on it. Ross, we're out of time, but I appreciate your sharing the story with us, and I wish you the best. PWSFRAP, FRAP.org. People can find out more about it. Ross Mullins, thanks for being with us today, Ross. It is 16 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
So you spin to the right, then spin to the right, then spin to the right again. Then you spin clockwise, spin to the starboard, spin to the right, and then you move a little bit abrupter. You're our nation's finest interrupter. Yours is the last word and first word. All the words in between and a rude outburst word.
And welcome back, my friends.
I put the bull in bully.
Oh, really?
No, O'Reilly.
Oh. Yes, Nancy Anton is with us with the News the Hounds. They watch Fox, so you don't have to. Hey, Nancy.
Hi.
Newshounds.us?
That's right.
There you go. I'm looking at your website. There's just a bunch of amazing stuff on here right now for you have been doing in this arduous job of watching Fox so that we don't have to. Thank you so much, Nancy.
My pleasure.
What do you see as the major stories and the major frames and spins that Fox is throwing out there to the American public right now?
Well, one of the things that I thought was fascinating was Michael Chertoff talking about martial law. It ties in very nicely with, if you'll recollect, a couple weeks ago, Bush talking about using the military at home to quarantine people in case of the bird flu.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all of a piece of this fascist, you know, let's use the military for everything.
Yeah, Abe Maslow, the famous psychologist, once made the remark, if the only tool you have is a hammer, every solution looks like a nail. And
I love that. Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And that's the thing. I mean, these guys know force and violence,
right.
And that's it.
Right.
You know, that's it.
Right.
They don't understand democracy. They don't understand negotiation. They're about force and violence, and the means justify the ends, and intimidation and threat.
Yep.
And there are always going to be some people in a society who are going to say, yeah, okay, we'll hand you our liberty if you'll give us safety.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Chertoff, you think, is promoting the meme of preparing us for a police state, essentially?
I think they keep running it up the flagpole and seeing who salutes. Just throwing it out there and seeing how badly people react or how well people react.
And what sort of response are they getting?
I think they're getting a scary response, or a response that appalls me, where people are saying, if it's for our security, let's do it. If it will increase our safety, let's do it.
Mm-hmm.
And that brings to mind the old, you know, Franklin, those who are willing to sacrifice liberty for security deserve neither.
Right, yeah. And similar quotes from the founders about the whole thing. So are the various... I don't want to call them reporters. I'm not pontificators. The various commentators on Fox, are they? I mean, is this a major meme that is being pushed a lot, or is this just an interesting thing that happened in one show?
At least a year, mm-hmm. with Fox reporters generally being behind this idea, not terribly overtly, But I recall, for example, on Fox News Live, them being very in favor of, you know, we don't need no stinking Fourth Amendment, we don't need no stinking Fifth Amendment, you know,
right,
that kind of thing.
This stuff is used to protect criminals.
That's
how
right.
Dare they? You know,
that's
we,
right. If you're yeah. if you're a law-abiding citizen, you don't need this kind of stuff, you know.
Which was, by the way, one of Hitler's major memes, was if you're a law-abiding citizen, you have nothing to fear from the Nazis.
Mm-hmm.
And for those law-abiding citizens in Germany, for a long time, that was true.
Right.
For a long time, not for the whole time.
No.
You also have a story, Hannity Tells the Truth. What's that?
There was, there's a couple of threads that relate to Hannity, and one of them is the environmental shift that's sort of starting to take place on Fox. And it's about the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge.
Mm-hmm.
They had a special on global warming that turned out to be not so special.
Mm-hmm.
But the very fact that they even had one was sort of a major step forward, because they don't generally, and generally the only time the environment is mentioned is to trash eco-terrorism,
right,
or tree huggers or something like that.
Now, Nancy Antone with Newshounds.us, one of the things that I found fascinating is over the last year or so I've been seeing, or the last 6 months anyway, Matt Drudge actually giving a lot of coverage to kind of global warming stories. It seems like maybe the right wing is realigning itself, like they figured out they can't lie about this anymore, so they're going to have to embrace it.
That's an interesting point. I think you're right. It's become so, I think especially possibly with the hurricane and season that we've had, and that we're now up to, what, gamma for
mm-hmm.
tropical storms?
Yeah.
That maybe it's become so blatantly obvious that there's something going on. It may not necessarily be global warming, but there is something.
Right. So it'll become the next enemy that they're going to have to attack. We got to figure out a way to attack this thing.
Right. Who to blame for this?
Right. Yeah, it must have something to do with those Democrats.
And the liberals, that's right.
Yes, that's the next thing. How are the liberals responsible for global warming? Well, of course, it's because the Hollywood movie stars have mansions. That's got to be it.
There you go. They were attacking Barbara Streisand again.
Yeah, it's going to be Barbara Streisand's limousine. That's what it's going to be, I guarantee you. Without any discussion of Hannity's private jet or his flying around in private jets and all that. Anyway, okay, Nancy Antone with Newshounds.us. They watch Fox, so you and I don't have to. Thank you, Nancy, for the
you're
great
welcome.
Service you're doing to your country and to all of us. Good talking with you. 27 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, I left Kentucky back in 49 and went to Detroit working on assembly line. The first year they had me putting wheels on Cadillacs. Every day I'd watch them beauties roll by, and sometimes I'd hang my head and cry, 'cause I always wanted me one that was long and black. One day I devised myself a plan that should be the envy of most any man. I'd sneak it out of there in a lunchbox in my hand.
You can tell that one's coming
now,
to no good.
Meant getting fired, but I figured I'd have it all by the
time. Oh, my good old Johnny Cash.
I'd have me a car worth at least $100,000.
34 minutes past the hour. Welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. the best laid schemes of mice and men, right? Of plans of mice. This is what's happening right now to Pat Robertson. The Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, yesterday was their deadline to report on their progress on how this investigation is going with the administration's spinning pre-war intelligence. You know, Pat Robertson was supposed to look into this back on November 1st. He said, you know, they said, you guys have been delaying this thing. You're stonewalling this thing. He says, no, we haven't been delaying it. He says, as a matter of fact, it's been ongoing. As a matter of fact, we've been doing our work on phase two. See, phase one was how did the CIA screw up, basically? How did the intelligence community screw up? Phase two is what did the administration do with that information? Phase two, it turns out, is not going so well. According to Senators John Rockefeller and Carl Levin and Dianne Feinstein, they wrote a letter and, well, here's a sentence from it. At this time, we are unable to provide an estimated completion date of the Phase 2 investigation given the substantial amount of work that remains to be done. Excuse me, they released a letter. This is the letter from Pat Roberts. Pat Roberts saying, well, you know, I don't know. Pat, when are we going to learn what the administration did? Well, you're not going to learn. Chairman Roberts, this is a summary from the Center for American Progress. Actually, a blog posting by Faiz. Senator Roberts, number one, unwilling to investigate the cabal inside the Pentagon's Office of Special Plans. Because why? Well, because the administration really doesn't want to investigate itself. And he's saying, well, okay, that makes sense. And number two, he's been unwilling to allow for, quote, additional interviews and documents, end quote, to conduct a thorough inquiry. How are you going to do an inquiry into how the administration cooked the books if you don't have interviews and documents? Magic, I guess. That must be it. Or maybe it's just, you know, intelligent design. Maybe it's just going to spring into... No, it's... Also, it's important to note, I think Progress notes, that while Bush continues to falsely claim that the Senate Intelligence Committee found the administration had not manipulated the intelligence, misled the American people about why we went to war, the Intelligence Committee senators say just the opposite. This from the senators on the committee. The committee staff work on two other sections of the investigation is not finished. Whether the public statements were substantiated by intelligence information and the use of intelligence information provided by the Iraqi National Congress. That's Ahmed Chalabi's group. Ahmed Chalabi being paid a couple hundred thousand dollars a month to provide intelligence to this administration prior to the war. My recollection is it was around $300,000. Who knows? Anyway, it's pretty mind-boggling. 1-866-440-THOM, our number, 1-866-440-8466. William in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania on the line. Hey, William, welcome to the program.
I'm a steady listener of yours, Tom.
And, well, thank you, William.
My question is, have you found out anything concerning Cindy Sheehan or her whereabouts, being that she has dropped out of the news?
Well, she's not been covered so much, but she apparently has been around. It's interesting, the last time we asked this question,
yeah.
I got a bunch of emails from people saying, oh, she's here and she's there and she's giving a speech here. And you know, the news blackout on, you know, she's out and around and speaking up. And, in fact, hopefully we'll be speaking with her soon. She has a book that just came out,
yes.
For which I wrote a chapter. I just got a copy of it yesterday. They're at home. I don't remember the title, but if you just go to Amazon or any of the book selling websites and type in Cindy Sheehan, you'll see the book.
Okay,
you can easily Google it. But the point is that she's probably going to have to fairly soon be doing book interviews to promote the book. But whether she's going to end up back at the White House, she apparently had been dogging Bush. But what's happened is that the media has decided that she's kind of an old story, I guess. You know, it's this meme that seems to follow the media from time to time. Dear President Bush says, was that Alex? Is that you saying that? Or Dan? Alex or Dan there at Air America is suggesting to us that Dear President Bush is the title of the book. And makes sense to me. Anyhow, yeah, it's from Dan. So, Dear President Bush, Cindy Sheehan's book. Thank you, Dan. And... We'll bring you up to date on it, William. We'll find out here pretty shortly.
Thank you, Tom.
Okay, good talking to you. Tim in Peoria, Illinois, you're live and on the air. Hey, Tim, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for the daily dose of sanity.
You're welcome. I do my best.
Do you remember a few months back there was a survey of high school students, and it found a majority of them believe the news media has too much freedom?
Yes. I reported on this program.
Yeah. That was pretty stunning, wasn't it? And that was the window on the mindset of high school students. Today I got a glimpse of the mindset of college students, and I want to pass that observation along.
Okay.
Today, I went to a screening of the new movie about Walmart. It's called The High Cost of Low Prices.
Right.
And this was in a sociology class at Bradley University in Central Illinois.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this isn't a little school somewhere in lower Mississippi.
Right.
There was about 30 kids in the class, and after the film, the teacher asked for questions and comments. All these kids sat mute, deer in the headlights look.
Yeah.
There wasn't going to be any questions and comments, and so the teacher went on to lecture them about these problems, you know, that are all connected: globalization, free trade, the anti-labor movement in the U.S. and the world, fascism, etc. The kids were clueless. They knew nothing about any of this stuff. After the class, I asked the teacher if these kids would even know what democracy is. He told me flat out he's asked class before, and they didn't know.
Yeah, and that's the tragedy. We no longer are teaching, and this really goes back, as far as I can tell, it goes back to right around the beginning of the Reagan era. We stopped teaching, and you know, most of us are not in school anymore. We haven't been paying attention. In fact, it'd be interesting to get somebody on from one of the National Education Associations and see if they're, you know, if this is just like, you know, kind of a whole, you know, millions of little steady erosions in local school districts, or if this was something that happened nationwide. But for all practical purposes, we don't teach civics any longer in the United States. We don't teach American history. I remember in the, you know, third or fourth grade, we had to memorize the preamble to the Constitution and the Gettysburg Address, and not just memorize them, but understand what they meant, the context in which they were written, the seven parts of the preamble to the Constitution, why they were significant. And this is just the preamble, right? We learned this is all elementary school that I'm talking about. You know, we learned a mnemonic device for memorizing the first 10 amendments to the Constitution. And what they meant and what they stood for. And as far as I can tell, kids coming out of school today don't, I mean, it's not just that they're clueless. It's like a vacuum.
Well, they have no grip at all on what it means to be a citizen in a democracy.
Yeah.
They don't even know what a society is. They don't know what collectivism is.
One of the things that really concerns me, Tim, I was having this conversation yesterday with Mark Crispin Miller. He was here in town doing a book tour. He came on, well, he was on the program, you probably heard it, and afterwards he and I went out to luncheon, and he had just the day before given a speech downtown at the Unitarian Church where I've spoken here in Portland, Oregon a number of times, and it's sort of like the, you know, community central for folks coming through town, and one of the better venues, actually, hold 500-600 people, and he said, you know, there were no teenagers there. There were no college kids there. It's like, where are they? What's going on? It's not just here. It's like all, and I see the same thing traveling around the country, giving speeches on these issues, is that, you know, it's the people of my generation, the people who came of age in the 60s and 70s, and occasionally the very young people, that is people, you know, 17, 18, 19, 20, in that, you know, I'd say up to maybe 25 or so. But there seems to be this giant hole from somewhere around 22, 23 to around probably 40 where I think civics education kind of dropped off the edge of the earth. Or maybe it's a generational thing, or maybe I'm just hallucinating it. I don't know. But I'm curious about it. I'm fascinated by it.
Well, I'm fascinated by it as well. You know, when you can be among a group of bright college students and they don't have a grasp, even a fundamental grasp at all, of what society is, of what a community is, of what a democracy is, what we are as a people in a democratic society, they haven't got any idea. They simply don't know.
We're losing our foundational stories.
It's absolutely, absolutely stunning.
Yeah.
And, you know, people need to think about this, and I don't know what to do about it, but it is, when you see it right in front of your face, it's just stunning.
Well, and the answer of the more vocal minority among our population is, let's teach intelligent design. Yeah, we've got a problem in our schools. Let's teach intelligent design. So, amazing. Tim, thanks a lot for the call.
You're welcome,
Tom. Good to hear from you, and I'm glad to know that you're out there talking to our students and the young people in this country. We're going to take back this country. We're going to have a revival of democracy in America. It's going to have to be the people who are still going to be alive 30 years from now, not just also us old farts. Well, hopefully I'll still be around, but who knows? 45 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Sitting in the morning sun, I'll be sitting when the evening comes, watching the ships roll in, then I'll watch them roll away again. Yeah, I'm sitting on the dock of the bay, watching the tide roll away.
Oh, it sounds like a plan. Welcome back. 9 minutes before the hour. So, you know, sometimes we need to just kind of sit back and reflect. I'm continuously amazed about once every, I don't know, 6 months or so, there'll be some article in literally in the science journals. I subscribe to a bunch of them talking about the benefits of prayer, or meditation, or vacations, or just, you know, disconnecting a little bit and breathing deeply or taking a good walk in the woods. And, yeah, it's real. Anyhow, welcome back to our program. Doug in Sarasota, Florida, on the line with some thoughts on students today.
Hi, Tom.
Hey, Doug.
How you doing?
I am great, but I'll get better. You are live and on the air. What's up?
I just wanted to provide some observations about students right now. I'm a faculty advisor for a progressive club in Catherine Harris's district. And
I've been doing
that for a couple of years, and I've seen some encouraging things. I mean, the students are definitely waking up, which is particularly satisfying in a pretty conservative area. But there's definitely problems. The club I'm advising collected petitions protesting the fact that President Bush recently, suspended the Davis-Bacon Act.
Right.
And I remember mentioning this to my class and how, we're going to take these petitions and send them off to President Bush himself. And one student raised his hand and said, "You mean you can do that?" And it was shocking. They didn't realize that, their government actually is answerable to them. And
yeah.
It was really shocking. But
I think, we've had, again, not to place everything at the feet of Ronald Reagan, but he really did establish this kind of imperial presidency idea. I suppose Nixon, to some extent, and even Kennedy, to some extent, had the, we're bigger than life to them. But Reagan really, the pomp and ceremony and the grand balls and all this kind of stuff, and as in ballrooms, and it just has, I think particularly with this administration, it has really, really moved forward of they're untouchable. I mean, George W. Bush not only doesn't want to hear from us, he doesn't even read the newspapers.
Yeah, absolutely. But there's encouraging things happening. I have military students who I've noticed a change in the air. I used to have military students who were, right in line with the administration. And recent months, when I have students come back from Iraq, they seem to be going just the opposite direction. They're becoming much more critical. But anyway, keep up the good work.
Thank you, Doug. Good to hear from you, and I appreciate the call. Folks are waking up. I mean, that's the bottom line. There's no way around it. Carlana, is it Carlana in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania?
Yes.
Hey, Carlana. Welcome to the program.
Hi. I'm calling about Bush doing the same thing to the Pakistani people that he did to the people in New Orleans. There's a couple of million people that are freezing in Pakistan, and the first, I think he came out with 50 million and then 150 million, which is chump change if we're spending $1 billion a week in the war in Iraq.
Yeah, so, almost 2 billion.
Yeah, so I've been harassing Senator Spector and Santorum's offices. It seems to me that China makes all the ski clothes and winter clothes now. It looks like they could vacuum the air out of those winter coats and winter clothes and airdrop them in this area where the people are freezing.
Yeah.
And if you wait too long, it's not going to make any difference because they'll be dead. So
It is a humanitarian crisis of nearly biblical proportions, Carlana. I agree with you. There is a larger issue, though, and it's the one that I think nobody's talking about and somebody needs to raise, and that is that Pakistan is not without resources. This is a major country that's receiving billions of dollars in foreign aid from the United States, has a multi-billion, I don't know if they've approached a trillion, but a multi-hundred billion dollar a year economy, and they have a nuclear weapon. I mean, they've got a huge military power, and they could divert some of that money away from their military and help their own people. Why don't we lobby Pakistan, because they're actually there, and they've got their own cash and their own bank accounts. Why don't we lobby Pakistan to take care of its own people or shame them into it?
Well, I don't know the details of how much money the Pakistanis had. I had the impression that it was a relatively poor country.
It is a poor country at the level of the average poor person. It's basically a feudal state where you've got a few very, very wealthy people, mind-bogglingly wealthy, and the government works mostly to their benefit. And you got a lot of people who are basically kind of living on the edge, and there's not much of a middle class outside of the big cities. But that doesn't mean that the country itself doesn't have certainly enough resources to deal with the disaster in Kashmir, and that's, you know, that would be my first push. I mean, I'm all in favor of the United States being a good neighbor around the world, and I'm not opposing your suggestion that we push the government to say, hey, a few million dollars is nothing for what's going on over there. You know, certainly if we're borrowing $2 billion a day just to keep our government going, you know, you could argue that that means we don't have the money to do it. On the other hand, you could argue, you know, we're pretty loose with money. Let's give a little bit to the Pakistanis. But I think that we need to be encouraging Pakistan as well. Carlana, thanks for the call. Very quickly, I want to get Roy and Rio Rancho in here. Roy, we've only got about a half a minute left. You wanted to make a quick comment about New Mexico and voting machines?
Well, just in the Bernalillo County, which is the biggest county in the state, the county clerk refused to allow the lawyers to inspect the voting machines. We're involved in a great big voter registration reform suit, massive stuff. I'll call back when we can really discuss it. But voteraction.org, if somebody wants to really see how they can mess with elections, go to voteraction.org, and it has specific examples by the county in New Mexico, and it is staggering.
Okay, voteraction.org. We'll check that out. David, voteraction.org. Make a note. Thank you, Roy. And I had a story on that a few days ago. I didn't get to, and we'll have to get back to it. Good talking with you, Roy. Thank you very much for listening today. Thanks for being a part of our program, for calling in to our affiliates, our sponsors, the Dan and Alex in New York, and David here. Thanks a lot for being here for the program. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Pro. That's me. We'll see you tomorrow. Same time, same place. Take good care.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.